begins.
Oh, right.
The back row.
Episode 10.
Super.
Of?
Show.
Oh, got to sync up. Sorry.
No. This is the un-in-sync
version. Yeah. Episode
of
10.
The
Back Row Super Show.
Pod.
Cast. Okay, there we go. And now we're in sync.
All right.
Episode 10, Buy the Rights or Man, I Should Be a Producer. So we're going to talk about Buy the Rights, the card game.
Mm-hmm.
Came out, I think, 2013, 2014, maybe.
Yeah, I think you've been talking about it for a bit now, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, it's super fun. And man, we really should be producers. I think we can come up with some interesting content.
We should really be producers because we wouldn't be Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That did just happen.
Yeah,
that dates us a little bit for the people who are listening to this. But, yeah, no, that we would be better producers than Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, when you guys look up several years from now when this is in the trash bin of the internet, like way deep, and you look up Weinstein Company, and it no longer exists because they changed their name.
Changed their name?
No, I'm thinking ahead hypothetically.
Because, I mean, there's a lot of talk that they should, mm-hmm. but from a brand perspective, which is an evil way of looking at it, but my understanding is that was thrown out because Harvey, no.
His brother?
Or yeah, his brother.
His son, something like that.
I forget his brother's name. Mm-hmm. Is still on the board.
Oh, yeah.
So it's still mm-hmm. the Weinstein mm-hmm. Company.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I don't know. Branding perspective, they may want to change
that. I would get rid of it, and then I would just, every time I announced a movie or something of that nature, I would just go ahead and put like
The bad one.
No. Put like a pictograph of all the films they made, like, underneath it. So call themselves like the Splunlin Company, but then just put like a little pictograph with like all the movies they had right underneath it. So it'd be like a huge logo design thing, and then just gradually phase it out. And then maybe at the bottom, an asterisk that says not the Weinstein Company, just to reinforce that.
Yeah. I don't know about the graphic design there. They may want to hire someone to do that, but
that'd be awesome.
But, we'll talk about that later. Well, not the Weinstein thing, but
oh, we'll totally
rights.
Talk about that.
So we'll go into me time first, uh-huh. as always. Did you want to go first, or?
No.
No? Okay. Cool. So I will do the thing that I normally do and bring some music. Going to talk about Lou Reed's Transformer album. It's from 1972, so it's a... Not new. Yeah. So it was his second solo album after being in Velvet Underground. Like the first one, almost all of the songs were written while he was still in Velvet Underground. So, you know, he was kind of planning on leaving, I think. He was just stockpiling songs. And he was just like, yeah, no, I think I want to put this out. It's too good to put in the band.
Mm-hmm.
Which... I really like Lou Reed, but admittedly, everything I've read about him indicates that he's like the biggest prick in the world.
Yeah.
Like people even at his funeral called him an asshole. So
it's one of those lovable asshole things.
Yeah. I mean, so like, cause he's, in my opinion, one of the better popular songwriters, like, Leonard Cohen mm-hmm. is another one of his ilk. That's more, songs are a little bit deeper, even though they were, you know, I don't think Lou Reed's songs were on the radio as much,
mm-hmm.
but, so an interesting fact that I had to look up, and remind myself of, because I knew there was something weird about the cover. It's just a black and white picture of Lou Reed in, probably makeup, mm-hmm. cause there's dark circles around his eyes, but his face kind of looks like a skull. And I was like, there's something my dad told me about the reason why that photo looks the way it does.
Uh-huh.
And so I was digging around, and apparently the guy who took the photo at one of their shows, Mick Rock, overexposed that photo.
Okay.
Accidentally.
Oh.
My understanding is that he was smoking a joint, fell asleep and forgot about it, and then came back to the photo before it was just absolutely ruined. And I don't know what happened to the negatives. Maybe the negatives were trashed. Mm-hmm. And so he submitted that as, yeah, here's the cover album. And Lou Reed, kind of being the kind of a proto-punk type guy, kind of like Iggy Pop, just mm-hmm. was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And signed off on it for, I think RCA put it out.
Mm-hmm. What's the name of that album again?
Transformer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen that cover, but your description of it was...
Now, get this, like, because I was looking at old reviews of this going, now this is, because this is one of those albums that, like, oh, I think yeah. hits resurgence every now and then.
I don't even understand how, I guess I'm not really familiar with the elements of film, how that would impact it in that manner. As far yeah. as, like, overexposing it, how it would give you that image.
Yeah, oh, I think it just makes the white super white and the black super black. Mm-hmm. But no, it's
awesome.
It's one of those albums, I think, that, you know, iconic. I know I image. Listened to it because mm-hmm. my dad really likes Lou Reed. And so I picked it up. And yeah, I was just curious as to what critics back in the day thought. Mm-hmm. This is Nick Toschi, or Tosh, I think. T-O-S-C-H-E. Reviewing in Rolling Stone. Now, Rolling Stone was not the huge thing it was at the time. It had only been out, I think, 3 years or so, 3-4 years at this yeah. point. And it was an independent music rag, right? His review says that it stimulates the sexuality, but it's full of that artsy-fartsy homo stuff.
What?
What the fuck? Right? Like... That's like, I used to freelance review albums. That is not a good review at all for multiple reasons. Yeah. Wow. Not least of what, I mean, I know it's from the time period, but like mm-hmm. not least of which is the fact that he calls a lot of the subject matter on it that artsy fartsy homo stuff. Like that's wow. just ridiculous and hateful.
Yeah. You know, you would have people at that time who could have reviewed it, and if they didn't have prejudice about it, could have just either addressed that or left that alone. Because that's not even an element that will make up the album upon listening.
It really is not.
It's not like you listen to it, it's like, oh, there's some artsy fartsy homo stuff here.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of references to like gay culture and stuff at the time. Because Lou Reed is always written about New York, mm-hmm. right? And the seedier side of New York. And, you know, at the time, that would have encompassed gay subculture
yeah.
and references to clubs and mm-hmm. Andy Warhol's factory scene. So, yeah, like, that's just a really roundly bad review of it.
That's great.
So, David Bowie produced it along with Mick Ronson.
He's a hell of a producer.
He really is. Like, he has such a good ear picking really stuff out. And, yeah. I still haven't come to terms with it almost 2 years later. It's horrible. It's horrible. But yeah, Mick Ronson may be a familiar name. He's Mark Ronson and Samantha Ronson's father.
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of stuff with Bowie in the 70s, especially when he was coming to America. And, you know, Lou Reed and Bowie and Iggy Pop were all kind of in the same scene.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because Bowie, I think, was trying to breakthrough in America, because at the time he wasn't as popular. He was more of an underground artist here,
mm-hmm.
is my understanding. Let's see. So my favorite song on this album is Walk on the Wild Side.
Oh, yeah.
It's the one everyone has heard, yeah. even if you're not a Lou Reed fan. You know this song.
So many damn movies and
it really
product
is.
Placements. And
which is odd. Like, it... I don't want to talk about other things too much, but you know the Iggy Pop song, Lust for Life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lust for Life.
Where, yeah, exactly. So mm-hmm. Carnival Cruise, I think, used
yes.
it for...
Yes,
and I know Iggy Pop, so like he probably bought a car with what they paid him to do it, or bought a house or whatever. But that's an odd song for them to pick, because the whole point, like... story in that song is waiting on a drug dealer to show up so you can score off of him.
I mean, that's what you do on a Carnival cruise, right?
I mean, maybe. I don't
know.
I've never been on a cruise.
Sorry, Carnival.
Don't sue us.
You were going to be our sponsor, I know. You were close. You were close to contacting us, but we had to destroy that. Or at least I did. Don't blame Zach.
Oh, well. But that segues nicely into the thing. I guess we'll put a drop in here for the musical cue. Guys, enjoy Walk on the Wild Side.
Walk on the Wild Side. I said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, doot, 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 doot.
Story about Iggy Pop segues nicely into the other thing that I did recently, which was watch Gimme Danger.
Gimme Danger?
It's a documentary on the Stooges.
I was thinking every time you say segue, I should drop
like a
No. To be just drop like a bass drop. No, like wow.
Because it's not a subway.
And have it 15 seconds long, and then we'll continue on. Literally the worst segues. Figuratively the worst segues
I
could think of.
They're very tenuous.
Be great.
But it's a documentary on it's free on Amazon Prime. Because I think Amazon Studios actually put it out.
Really? Okay.
And who's I remember. it's a documentary. So.
Oh, it's a documentary.
Yeah, it's a documentary. Yeah. Okay.
I thought it was one of those biopic drama things.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, as much as I would love one, yeah, it's a documentary. It had a lot of archival interviews with people that they didn't reveal were archival until the very end of the movie, because three of the original Stooges are dead.
Yeah.
It's just Iggy Pop and James Williamson, the replacement guitar player that they picked up in the early 70s.
Okay.
A lot of the interviews, like, you know, the Ashton brothers died in like 2012 and 2014, and so it was new footage, but as a Stooges fan, I was watching it and was like, when is this from? Because it looks new, and it is relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's a lot of interesting stories about, like, apparently how they got dropped from Elektra was they were doing a tour, and the Ashton brother, I think Ryan Ashton, Scott Ashton, is the brother, the Ashton brother that's the drummer,
mm-hmm.
was driving this U-Haul filled with their stuff, right? 12-foot tall U-Haul, and passed under a bridge in California, and the clearance was 10 feet. And so the entire top of the U-Haul was jammed back, mm-hmm. and the bridge had severe structural damage, like hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of damage. Because he's not a professional roadie. Like, he's mm-hmm. just some dude driving a U-Haul. That story cracks me up.
So did Elektra drop him for that?
Yeah, I mean, their album sales weren't...
Okay, yeah.
Their album sales were never super high.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak.
You want to think about that in relation? Imagine the ratio of the Stooges' album sales as compared to their merch stuff.
Yeah, well, like, especially now, like, yes. You can go to a Hot Topic or a, mm-hmm. or whatever and get the photo of, like, shirtless Iggy, like, falling on the mic stand. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
just imagine, like, the ratio.
Yeah,
think about that. Get angry.
Oh yeah.
It's nothing to do with the music. I mean, image is cool stuff, and it's great to get good merch, but it's now that's even, I'm calculating in my mind, the stuff that's straight from China that Iggy doesn't see any royalties from. It just has, like, images and stuff put on there.
Well, so there's a... Iggy was sharing this funny story where when David Bowie produced his first album, brought him over to London. And, you know, for whatever reason, they just weren't clicking in the studio. And he's like, I got it. Let me get my guitar guy. Let's bring over one of the Stooges guys. And so they bring out a Stooge guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not really clicking with what they're recording. And so this is Iggy's first solo album.
Mm-hmm.
And he wheedles around with the manager and finally basically brings the other two Stooges into the studio. So he's like, yeah, my first solo album was a Stooges album. Like I kind of tricked them into hiring the Stooges as studio musicians.
Wow. I mean, that makes sense if you're used to, you know, building your musical identity in that environment.
Yeah.
Even branching out and trying to get something new, that'd be kind of difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, especially if you're in a weird random place being produced by some dude whose biggest claim to fame in America is that he's kind of girly and has a lot of red hair.
Yeah.
Who's like, yeah, really, I want to produce you.
Really into that artsy fartsy homo stuff.
Man, you are not going to let that drop, are you?
Because it's such a great, stupid quote.
Like, that's a stupid, stupid quote.
So great, dumb. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I did is we went to see Suspiria at the Plaza.
Yeah.
They're remaking that.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Which I kind of want to see. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I want to see how they will make it look better than the original, because the Plaza, they have digital projectors now. So, you know, Argento movies are very striking in, I think, the angularity.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the camera cinematography in it is really, really unique. Like, you know, shooting straight up in a building just to increase a sense of vertigo, right? I mean, I know Hitchcock did that, but Argento is a very visually striking director. Lots of jarring color schemes in the same spot, odd stories that don't necessarily translate into American. But it's a very interesting movie. Like, I would really like to see like a Rob Zombie take on it. I think he could do it justice.
Yeah.
Lords of Salem was good.
Yeah.
That's probably the closest movie I've seen to something like Suspiria.
Yeah, Lords of Salem, I never got around to watching that.
Oh, it's so good.
And there was so much press around it. Like, he really spent money. Who distributed that?
Was it
a bigger production company? So I think he had a lot of press for that movie.
Yeah, I think part of that is because it was his production studio that put it out.
Okay.
I
was listening to a podcast with him, with Chris Hardwick. And it was really interesting to listen to him talk about the, like, producing films and making them and what he felt about it.
I've heard that same interview on the Nerdist. I think it's hilarious that he's just this dude that lives in the middle of nowhere and, like, loves his goats. Like, he treats his goats like dogs.
Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, they're just like really big dogs, except they walk into your house and just shit randomly. He's like, they just, like, they don't think about, oh, I gotta hold this. It's like, no, it just comes out.
Yeah. Their diets are so fibrous, it just pushes all that out.
Just goes right on through.
I read a book. Bill Flanagan's U2 at the End of the World. Mm-hmm. It's not really a travelogue. It's kind of it's a nonfiction book where he wrote on U2 from 89 to, I think, 93.
Oh, wait, let me stop you. Let's go back a second.
Okay.
Summate kind of the slant of the Stooges documentary. Would you say it was trying to communicate a particular thing? Because usually they'll try to, like, have a central message for that.
Really, the thing that I got from it was that the Stooges just, as a band, just had shitty luck.
Okay.
I mean, they were lucky in that they got signed, but it was just kind of a fluke.
Mm-hmm.
One of their sister bands, the MC5, got signed by Elektra, and Danny Fields, the A&R rep that signed them, saw the Stooges open for the MC5.
Mm-hmm.
And called back his manager and said, hey, I got two bands to sign. And they're like, okay, well, you have $25,000. And this is in 66, that's a significant amount. I mean, that's a significant amount of money now, but especially for a bunch of dudes who just were playing like their fifth or sixth show. I think the MC5 got $20,000 for their recording advance and the Stooges got $5,000. Like, that's that's a pretty lucky break. But, you know, being dropped from the album for an accident, even though it was expensive, the Ashton brothers didn't really do anything else. The drummer brother played with a handful of kind of shitty punk bands that no one, I've certainly never heard of them. One of them was called like Hammerhead. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, punkheads, if we insult you.
Yeah.
Hammerheads was amazing.
I mean, I've never heard of them. The older brother that played bass, he just kind of sat in his house and smoked a lot of cigarettes and didn't do anything else and lived with their parents until he died.
Exciting. All right. That's it. Just wanted your little summary on that.
Yeah.
Continue on your book.
Yeah. But no, yeah. So, the Bill Flanagan book is interesting to me. I read it every couple of years because it's written very well, because I feel like you feel what it's like to be on the road with a touring band.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is at a level where you're like, you don't necessarily, like, you couldn't just hop in a van and recreate this with some shitty bar band that mm-hmm. you have. Like, these are artists that sell tens of millions of copies of their albums. But it highlights certain instances, like they're all waiting in an airport to catch a plane to Mexico
mm-hmm.
to play a show in Mexico City. And he's noting down this exchange between the band members where they're like, ha, our road manager said we'd have to be at the airport by 10 o'clock to make this flight. And we wouldn't be able to play the show tonight if we weren't here in time. Well, it's 10:30 and no one's come to get us yet. And he notes, you know, when you hit a certain level of success, you're moved around like very expensive pandas. You're mm-hmm. just waiting on handlers to move you.
Mm-hmm.
So they all kind of look at each other and then go, oh shit, we need to make it to the runway.
Right? Oh, gosh.
Because they've missed their flight. Now they mm-hmm. have to charter a flight to Mexico because mm-hmm. they were not acting like adults. But it's interesting because I think that was kind of, you know, you two at the like top of their musical prime or whatever, with the Achtung Baby and Zooropa follow up.
Mm-hmm.
Two of their more popular albums that they recorded back to back. And it also came out at a time when, you know, grunge was kind of the big thing in America. And there were mm-hmm. a lot of bands that didn't try new things. And so, like, Bruce Springsteen put out an album in the early 90s, but it sounded like stuff he did in the 70s, and it was a flop.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, like, Nirvana was, like, number one forever.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, it kind of highlights that they kind of took chances and sink their own money into a bunch of stuff that they do. You know, the writer points out, like, yeah, on paper, they're worth X millions of dollars, but 90% of that goes back into funding the organization that puts them on the road. And mm-hmm. like, so they see very little of the money, or at least at the time they did. I'm sure now they see almost 100% of it. But it's interesting, this, you know, this book came out in 94, 95, and it's kind of prescient in that there's a scene where they're talking about, yeah, you know, the day's not far before, you know, we can just submit this on a computer and the record company gets it, and then it goes up and it's piped into someone's household. And it's like, wow, he's talking about iTunes like
mm-hmm.
6 years before iTunes is a thing.
Yeah. Smart.
But yeah, no, it's an interesting book. If you like nonfiction musical biographies, I recommend it. And then I guess the last thing that I did that I'll talk about before we go to your me time
mm-hmm.
is I finished Assassin's Creed Syndicate on PS4.
Oh, cool.
I played that game completely wrong.
Ah.
So my experience was much different.
Mm-hmm.
I completed all of the side quests. Like, I cleared the map of them before moving on the story quest, because I know in a lot of open world games you hit a certain point and then they're no longer available.
Mm-hmm.
So I may miss out on an item or a bounty or whatever. And so I completed all of them. So I had maxed out my level on both characters, or near enough. Like, mm-hmm. I was maybe one or two skills away from maxing it out. So when I started the story mode, I was just a running rampant over everything. Mm-hmm. Like, when I started the story, I had bought enough perks in the, like, atmospheric things that influence your gang, so that the gangs that I was supposed to be fighting with didn't really touch my gang, because I had bought out the perks where it's like, well, I own the cops, I'm not going to get arrested. They're not going to fuck with me on my turf because I own this map now.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I don't think I got the same experience as most people. Yeah, most because people, I played it wrong.
Mawako Surge, she's playing it now, and she has to kind of be very careful and be very cognizant of where she starts conflict. Because if she goes ahead and fights the wrong group of people, if there's two or three officers around, like, they're going to club her to death.
Oh, yeah.
Easily. Because they're bruisers. And then that'll call the attention of others from that the gang that's, you know, in opposition to her. And so she'll die, which is all the time. So it's a much more dangerous area. Yeah. Just doing anything.
Yeah. No, I did it wrong, admittedly. It was still a lot of fun. It was interesting switching between the two characters. Mm-hmm. I still prefer, I think his name's Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
I've started another game, so I've kind of put this out of my mind, but mm-hmm. other than beating it wrong. I like him just because he's a big badass bruiser.
He's a bruiser. He just likes hitting people.
I don't like sneaking around. Like, I'm no good at the, like, Hitman games, even mm-hmm. though they're fun, because my method of getting the target dead is just like, well, time to throw some grenades in there. Let me rig up this car bomb. Let me not kill this guy in the subtlest way possible.
And I've seen, like, Hitman people where they're, like, sniping from across the way. It's like hundreds of meters away, just waiting for them to come through.
Yeah.
And Zach's there's another Hitman hundreds of meters away, and he sees Zach's Hitman coming through, walking right by him, just, like, throwing some grenades. He's like, fuck, the guy was about to get him, this motherfucker. And then he sees your character running around, trying not to get killed, because he's alerted everybody in the area.
Hey, the simplest way to the end point is probably the most correct, right? Or the most direct, whatever. Mm-mm. I don't know the saying.
Great.
So that's my me time for this week. Mm-hmm. What did you do?
Record time. Let's see.
Ooh, right. You went record shopping?
No. Well, I did go record shopping.
Oh.
With my wife's friend. And we went to Criminal Records.
I love that place.
Which is down by Little Five Points. And it's a unique little store. The staff there are very nice. Which is not always the case in some record shops.
No, especially not here in Atlanta.
Yeah, I don't know why that is. One thing, too, which was funny, she was talking about how nice she found the staff when she was, like, asking them questions and stuff like that. Because
your wife or her friend?
Her friend.
Oh.
Her friend that came to visit, because my wife wasn't there. And so she went in, because she's talking about a lot of times she'll go into record shops and she knows, like, the particular pressing she's looking for. She knows the years that it would have been released. Uh-oh. She knows gradations for all the different kinds of, you know, qualities that you would have and et cetera.
Let me guess where this is going.
But then she goes in and people are just like, oh, you're buying something for your boyfriend, right? And you don't know shit about records. You don't know shit about records.
Jesus.
And she's like, no, I was going to come in here and buy a $200 record. Like, I know exactly what I'm looking for. Could you?
Guess what?
Like, oh, yeah, no, that's what I'm, I don't want that. That's
you don't one. Have to have a penis to be interested in really nerdy, geeky shit. Okay.
That's great.
I would think that especially someone who works in a record store would know that. Like, that's ridiculous.
I'd say it's definitely less so. It's kind of the comic book character in The Simpsons. What is his name?
Oh, comic book guy? I don't know his name other than comic book guy.
I think he might just be comic book guy. I'm sure he's had his name released sometime by now. But it's the same thing with comic book guy, where you come in, he just assumes you don't know shit about anything. And you could know more than he does, but you don't, you know, you can't possibly have any kind of expertise. And then just sprinkle in a little bit of sexism. Just like sprinkle it on the top. But they were really nice there, so to their credit there. They're really great, and I was actually looking for some Jim Lee art, and specifically they have a line. I think it's called God, I don't know, something like unleashed or unhashed, unworked, something like that, where they basically get the artwork as it was originally penciled before it gets colored in and inked, and so you can just see all their line work, and that's pretty cool. But he said that they don't sell them all the time. And when they do get one in, it just kind of sells. And they only have so much floor space there.
Yeah, Criminal Records is really tiny. It's mainly records.
Yeah, it's mainly
and then
records.
There's a wall with comics and Funkos and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's mostly, they have a lot of collections.
Yes.
Yeah, is that anthology? Is that the correct word for that? Or a collection or paperback?
Trade. I know when I was in there a couple weeks ago, like I picked up the 28th volume of Walking Dead, the trade, and then a couple of albums. So yeah, like it's really fun to go, but yeah, they don't have the widest selection.
So other than that, my parents' basement, I really like, cause instead of the records, you have comic books and then alcohol. And it's just
like,
and
my parents' basement is the name of the location, not his literal parents' basement.
I mean, my parents' basement's good too. There's plenty of alcohol.
Well, describe
if I
it
need
because
it.
I've never been.
Really? It's so nice. It's even a smaller comic book section, sort of. And they also have like little events and stuff, whatnot.
Oh, okay.
Kind of like you'd have at another game place.
Do they mainly do singles, or is it more like a comic book shop with a bar inside? Or
yes, it's like a comic book shop with a bar inside.
Oh, okay.
And but the bar is much larger section. So it's a lot like as far as the amount that you'd have in Criminal Records.
Right.
Maybe a little bit more, but not that much more.
Okay.
It always seems comic books, unfortunately, unless you're a specialty shop, and even in that case, they're not a big moneymaker. If you have a community that comes and supports you and you do a lot of other stuff, you can kind of stay afloat. But definitely it's the bar section that's holding up. I would imagine.
Yeah,
it's
probably that's the thing that's propping up their business.
And the alcohol's good there too. So Criminal Records was great, and I was looking for some Jim Lee art, and they didn't have it, so I went ahead and got some Todd McFarlane art because Todd McFarlane likes making money, and he's very good at it. So he made.
Well, they're kind of similar too, to my eye. I'm not an artist or anything, but
they come from a stylistic period.
Yeah.
So their arts carry a lot of hatching and line detail.
Right.
That was a big thing at the time. With printing being improved and the printing process being improved, they could represent that. So you could see something of a particular quality on the page. It wasn't, you know, as it is now, which there's a certain glossiness sometimes, I think, to the pages now that can be kind of distracting, make them a little harder to read, but you know, you do get a better visual representation with that.
Well, wasn't that his thing when he started Image, was that they printed all of their issues on that like high glossy expensive paper rather than just like the pulp stuff?
Yeah. It makes the colors pop. You can get better colors.
That's what you get with an artist run studio.
Yeah. You could, the colors pop, and it was really funny to read about Image and how they originally started doing the colors, because they'd have like the inkers and the colorists come in, and they were trying to use digital in order to improve the representation on the page.
Right.
And they were using Photoshop when they started to try to improve on that process, but they didn't have any idea how to use Photoshop. And there weren't like tutorials.
Yeah.
There wasn't like how to do a comic book page in Photoshop. There wasn't how to make sure your colors translate from digital media to print.
Oh,
because
wow.
it's a different can be a different color representation, sure, depending on your monitor and whatnot. And so you basically just had artists teaching themselves how to do Photoshop. It's like, I think we can do this. And of course, you know, they succeeded. So I don't think I've seen the original stuff, but I have seen some of the trades when they've collected. I had a couple of those of Todd McFarlane's Spawn.
Right.
Collected editions, and there's great, great colors, great representation. One thing, too, I really like that style, particularly for the line-heavy detail stuff that they emphasized and they did back then, which I imagine took a lot of time, which is maybe why they don't do that as much now. And it's just about a cleaner presentation, a cleaner line. Even if you look at, I was looking at this Superman collection, also by Jim Lee, and comparing it to some of his older stuff.
Yeah.
You hold them side by side, and it's like, this is still the same artist, but there's been a development. It's kind of a refinement and removal of some of that inside detail.
Right.
Not to a detriment to the art, but where you kind of streamlined it, it seems like.
Sure.
Less busy. And so that was good. I still want to get Batman Hush, which is what I originally came in there for.
I've never read that line.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of other arcs, you know, that I want to take a look at. That one particularly, I think the art I've just seen is really, really stellar. So I'm just trying to get back into that.
Gotcha.
As Zach knows, you know, I like to dive deep.
Yeah.
Nerd into things until I've dug out the hole. I can go no further, but there's definitely quite a bit further I can go. So with this, so it's great. And so Criminal Records, we went to this clothing store that I told Zach about, pretty sure, where they were selling basically things that you could get from Goodwill, like $3-$4 shirts. Like, oh, shirts, the kind of shirts that would say like New Orleans soccer team 1997, you know, those kind of things. Yeah. That just like the crappiest cotton that you could imagine, and other things.
Was this my brother's daughter's basement or?
No, let's not name the place.
Oh,
that wasn't okay. It though.
Oh, so. Okay.
But I found it kind of odd because they were selling those shirts and stuff for like $20, $30. It was like, it was curated Goodwill stuff for prices I wouldn't imagine paying new for that. I mean, these aren't comfortable shirts. Like, these are just bottom barrel.
Jesus.
And it's just really, really intense. They did have very nice scarves. I did notice they had some nice scarves.
Wasn't there a woman that turned this into a business out in San Francisco where like she was basically dumpster diving and stealing shit from Goodwill and then curating like high fashion, quote unquote, and then charging like $150 for a pissed-in t-shirt?
Yeah, I could see that, yeah.
All
so
right.
Anyways, they were very nice at this store. And I'm sure they serve a market segment that is willing to pay those prices.
Sure.
They were very nice. It's not something I'd really be interested in. One, because when I go into a Goodwill, part of it is looking on the find and finding something that works for me, like that beautiful Batman.
I love that shirt.
Yeah. What do they call that? It's a
neon tank top.
It's a tank top. I was trying to think of the good. Good name for that.
Like high-vis yellow tank top.
It's so beautiful. It was waiting for me there to rescue it.
It was calling to you. Like, it was just waiting for
Richard. I saw this, like, neon glow in the racks, and I was like, what is this? And then I saw the Batman chest symbol, and I was like, yes!
Not the original, the Michael Keaton Batman symbol.
It's so great. So good.
Probably from 1989.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so good. Where could you wear that, though, other than, you know, if
you
were
wore
doing
it
like
out,
a,
I thought.
Well,
somewhere.
Where could you wear that reasonably, other than like a early 90s boy band music video? That's where it would fit. And you were just like, yeah, the girl is mine, you know, something
maybe
like that.
Gym?
No, unless it's like artsy fartsy like homeless stuff, Jim. Maybe that. And so that was a great place. And they had boots and stuff, and the boots were just really worn, and I would never pay those prices for that. But again, super nice.
Okay.
They serve a market segment. Totally cool with that. That's their game. It's just not my game.
Okay.
That's fine. And I like to be a little more political than Zach as far as...
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of patience for bullshit.
No. That's their market. Let's move on. And so other than that, yeah, I mentioned I've obviously been getting back into drawing and et cetera. It's always something I was interested in. Like I took pottery in high school, and before that I did like basic art classes and painting and stuff in high school. And I was always really discouraged by my initial attempts to do something that was representational, like to get, you know, like a can or like a pear,
yeah,
and work it on, you know, from there. But I was like, you know, I'm 30 now. I can get any younger. If I do want to do that and get better at it, I might as well try to practice and see what I can do. And just in like basic stuff, like I've noticed that being able to draw lines like cleanly and doing like circular shapes, circles too are a huge thing.
Yeah.
Like getting a clean representational circle, it's not really what is used a lot. Like if you want a perfect circle, a perfect sphere, usually a lot of the times they'll just kind of sketch out, even if you're going to do like a shaded 3D one, you'll kind of sketch it out a little bit at a time and you'll kind of connect it together, you know, and then
you're not freehand Da Vinci.
You're not freehand Da Vinci making that. And even then I'm sure he had tools.
Yeah. He probably knew how a compass worked.
Yeah. He had different tools and things. You could see like when he was building, representations and figuring out proportions and ratios of the human, you can see that there's obviously been, he's used like a tool set in order to map out proportions.
The man, mm-hmm. Yeah. The arms outstretched thing. Yeah.
And, so that's a combination. Da Vinci's kind of a combination of, you know, part scientist, part artist, and
right,
genius. And so I've been really encouraged by that. Like I have been able to do other things, and I understand a bit how lighting works and figuring out shading and the importance of good tools. Like trying to draw something that doesn't look like shit using a number 2 pencil and notebook lined paper, it's a huge difference from having like actual, even if it's just sketch paper, like it's not the kind of stuff that you'd, you know, put like a finished work on, even just sketch paper and some good pencils, some good graphite pencils. And, they're just fine. You can do a lot with it. So I'm enjoying that process and look to see where that goes.
Yeah.
So I don't think.
You guys went to the Wuxtry, right?
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't.
My wife did. My wife and her friend did. And, oh, I need to play The Evil Within 2. Like, I bought that.
Oh, really?
On sale. Because they had it, you know, the game comes out like $60, but Green Man Gaming for PC,
yeah,
they do sales too for PS4 occasionally, like, you know, digital content.
Yeah.
They had a sale on it so I could get the game for $45.
Nice.
Which, you know, $50. So
yeah,
and
you could probably pick up a used copy of the first one just to get in the game.
Yeah,
because like I have one sitting on my shelf right now that I've yet to play, mm-hmm. but I just keep meaning to get around to it and I haven't.
Yeah, I kind of have to do that, you know, when the wife's not home, and either that or put on headphones because she plays her Assassin's Creed game. It's so damn loud, so loud. I don't know why it's got to be that loud. And yeah, so put some headphones on that, Dark Knight. That's pretty much it for me, I'd say.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, look at that. We got about 20 minutes apiece for both of us. Look at
that. Oh, nice.
Record
look at that.
Time.
All We're right.
Rare form today.
Exactly. Well, it's been a while. Mm-hmm. Okay, so talking about By the Rights. This is a card game. It's kind of a party game. I picked it up for my wife for, I think, her birthday this past year. It popped up under a suggestion when I was on Amazon getting something else for And so I was just like, this looks like the game, a kind of game that we both would like. And we had a game night with it a while back, with you guys. And basically the purpose is it's a kind of a Cards Are type game, like Cards Against Humanity or Apples to Apples, where one person is, in this instance, the producer, right? So you have $20 million. You can split it up amongst any of the people making the pitch to you. And as long as it's a 5 or 10 or a 20, right?
Mm-hmm.
And basically the way the producer determines who wins is what sounds like it would work the best, as you would expect. So the players are each either given or randomly draw or are dealt two each of four different cards, right?
Mm-hmm.
One is the genre card. The second is the descriptor card. The third is the hero card. And the fourth is the plot card, right? And so they kind of jumble together the best pitch based on those items. So, you know, a round will take a while because people need probably 5 or 10 minutes to develop their pitch.
Yeah, put an idea together. I remember playing the game and going through several revisions and sort of last minute adjustments on what my particular plot line would be. It's an interesting game.
Yeah, so like for an example, something that's on their website, right, is for genre cards, action comedy or rock opera. For the descriptors, kung fu fighting and ex-military.
Mm.
For the hero, cat lady and roller derby girl. And then for plot, one of them is becoming a bounty hunter to pay off student loans, and the other is saving the world from an alien invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would put those together, one of each type, and you would make your pitch to the producer and be like, look, I got this movie with my ideas for a rock opera. We can get a hot up-and-coming band. Let's say we can get, let's get Taylor Swift to do the music. She'll write this rock opera, right? Mm-hmm. And it'll be about an ex-military roller derby girl, right? And why, like, we can comment on the disparate class identity in America and how you got to really work hard to pay your dues by making the plot. This roller derby girl has to put her skills to use and become a bounty hunter to pay off her student loans.
Roller derby bounty hunter sounds amazing.
Yeah, right.
I was initially gonna go ex-military cat lady because that seemed really cool. And then I couldn't figure out how she would have to be concerned about paying off her debts though. But that's really the whole dynamic of the game that Zach illustrated.
Yeah, like you can make pitches and cast it if you want. Like I always found it helped to cast things. And I think I took notes when we were playing about stories.
Now, I feel like there should be more points given for just weird oddball shit, because that's all I come up with. It's just like things that I think are awesome, but it was like, nope.
So one of the ones that we came up with was a revenge thriller comedy about a narcissistic yoga instructor surviving on the streets of New York City after being transformed into a cat. That cat voiced by Russell Brand. I could see that being made a movie. They made that movie called Nine Lives with Kevin Spacey, but it was boring as dog shit. Oh, they could spice it up by putting Russell Brand in there.
Yeah, he could totally do social commentary.
I think one your wife pitched was an action comedy about an influential member of Congress following a series of clues about the true history of the United States. The congressman would be played by Larry David, and his sidekick character, his bodyguard, could be played by Dwayne The Rock Johnson. I would watch that movie. One I came up with was a hipster beet farmer discovers the modern world after escaping from a religious cult.
That one sounds something that would appear on Sundance.
That beet farmer played by Keanu Reeves, though.
Yeah, that would totally be a Sundance film. It'd be amazing.
what was the, let's see. I think you pitched this one. Cyborg gym teacher making first contact with an alien race and no one notices his slow descent into cybermanity.
That sounds like possibly one of mine that I made.
Yeah, like it could be a comedy where, mm-hmm. where people are just treating him like he's just a regular everyday gym teacher, but every now and then he shows up and he's got more robot parts on him.
It's a funny thing, that sounds like either something I would have done or your wife would have done. And she's been listening to these, so if I take credit for something that she did, I'm going to hear about that shit.
Yeah.
So that might have been hers. Just saying, it might have been yours.
But no, I think it's a great way to have a fun party game with me.
It's a great game idea.
Yeah, I like the theme of the game, too. Because, you know, Cards Against Humanity is kind of played out at this point.
It's got one note to it, one tone.
Yeah, I mean, you can play for maybe, I think I would put up with maybe an hour of it, maybe. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a few rounds of it, of everyone just being the vilest, crudest person they possibly can. And it's like, okay, well, after a certain point, the shock kind of loses its shock factor.
Well, you'd need like new cards. You'd really have to play where, like, certain cards that are perioded or dated, you'd have to take them out.
Yeah.
I feel like you'd have to curate it in order to try to really keep it fresh. And it's like, if we've seen that one too many times, take it out the deck.
Yeah.
Because there's enough expansions to put in there.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, with By the Rights, like, there's not a whole, I don't think there are any expansions for it. Mm-hmm. I think what you get is, but, I mean, because you're using four of them every time you play your turn, like there are a lot of choices to be made that are already in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only so many ways you can fit them together, but that number is so high, yeah. And the rounds take so long that,
yeah.
You know, we played a couple of rounds over a couple of hours because everyone needed time to come up with their pitch.
Yeah. And yeah, there's enough variants available and availability of tone. So if someone wanted to do like a Sundance Keanu Reeves beet farmer film,
yeah,
they could pitch that. If someone wanted to do a Gonzo action movie,
yeah,
they could do that. And I think you could really,
you have to pitch it right to the person's taste. Like, I think I was getting the weirdest pitches because people know I have really odd tastes in movies.
I think that's my fault in playing these games. Just, I have the same thing with Cards Against Humanity. Most of the time, I will just play what I think is funniest and yeah. Fuck who's ever judging it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a downfall. Like someone pointed out to me that, there are specific cards they know they can play in Cards Against Humanity, and I will probably pick it because it's just the vilest shit.
Yeah, your wife picks you up like a piccolo flute and is like, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. She plays you totally in that game. She knows exactly.
She's very good at reading people.
But she's spent a lot of time with you, so obviously.
Yeah, that's true.
She's got it. She's got it down pretty pat.
Yeah, 9 years last week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm almost at the point I could build a...
A Hannabot?
No, I could build a Turing machine chatbot based on Zach.
Oh, on me.
And be like, can you tell, is this Zach or is this my Turing machine bot, Zach? Can you really? I don't know. Unless you start talking about, hey, Zach, like this really bad thing happened to me. Then you'll get some of the humanity. But on that surface level, I don't know. I don't know.
I'm a
about
simple
that.
Man.
I don't know about that. I don't want to code that, but I think I could.
But yeah, no, like I'm happy with this addition to our games collection. It's got a lot of replayability, just a lot of other Cards are games, just based on how long the turns take. You know, mm-hmm. like Cards Against Humanity and Apples to Apples, the round's over like that. Whereas this, you have to actually sit and plan out and think about what's going on. And
yeah, I mean, I had a lot of moments, too, where I would have a pitch, I'd have an idea. And much like you'd have in Hollywood, where you make two films back to back very shortly within one another about friends with benefits.
Yeah.
That would happen to me where someone would pitch something and I'd be like, God damn it, I was just about to pitch one of those elements as part of my plot line. I was like, now I got to change this whole thing up. Ah, I don't have time for this. Just push out the movie.
Yeah, I forget who won. I think it was either your wife or mine.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, like the interesting thing about this is, you know, unlike other Cards Are games where there's one winner for that hand or that turn, rather, you can split the money up and be like, okay, I'm the producer. I have access to $20 million. That's a good idea, but you don't need a whole lot of money to do it, which is, I think, how your wife was playing the game, where I was just like, I'm just grading them based on relevance. But she was just like, which changed how I pitched to her. Like, mm-hmm. I was trying to pitch the most outlandish blockbustery bullshit after mm-hmm. that, after she was like, okay, you wouldn't need a whole lot of money to make that, so I'm going to give you $5 million. Mm-hmm. And this one's got a lot of explosions, so you need like $10
million. Mm-hmm.
So then I was just like, okay, it's got to have explosions, it's got to have the rock, and it's got to have just a lot of, you know, you would have to be able to see it on a summer blockbuster screen.
Mm-hmm. It'd have to be dolphins exploding and fireworks.
Yeah. Baywatch. Watch it.
No.
So yeah, no, I like this game. Would you add it into your game collection?
I'd totally play that. I don't think my wife enjoys the social experience of playing it, but I don't think that particular kind of game gets her game juices kind of going.
Oh, gotcha.
Because it's one of those things where you have to be really quick and thinking on your feet. And my wife is a bit more reserved in that sense.
Ah.
So it's just not really the kind of tone of game that she usually prefers. Because she does have creative ability, but one of the biggest things that can stifle that for people is being self-critical. I think she's very self-critical.
Okay.
And so that little bit of added pressure and then having to do it extemporaneously, some people get excited by that because it's like, oh yeah, I can play with these things. Yeah. And some people are more like, oh man, I have the pressure. I got to put this whole thing on. It's like, oh my gosh, I have a show to put on. And so they just kind of like shut it down. So I find it hard to get those creative juices going.
Sure.
And so I definitely would love to play it in a group setting. There's a lot of games I'd have to try to figure out how to play them like two people at a time. Because there's a bunch. I mean, I'm not familiar with how flexible some games are to that kind of modification. Sure. Like, I'd love to play the Zombies game.
Yeah, I think you max out around 5 people with that one.
No. I mean, could you play it with 2 people? I totally would play that.
Pretty sure you could. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and it should have... Well, it's Twilight Creation, so probably not. But they should have a, like, this is what it's designed for
mm-hmm.
type thing. So
I just need to get it all out and play the Evil Within.
All right. So it sounds like we both like this game and mm-hmm. give it the back row stamp of approval.
Do we have a stamp?
No, but
I thought it was we could like make something. Come on your feet.
Yeah, I mean, I guess on the website, like I could post a picture of it and just kind of like when I get my computer back, Photoshop it like a thumbs up.
You know what you could do is you could just dip your like hand in ink
and punch.
You could punch it, the fist of approval, but you could also just like slap the wet, sloppy back of your hand on it, the back of your hand of approval. You know, hashtag domestic violence isn't cool. A nerd smack.
No. Yeah. So yeah,
you do butt cheek of approval, and then it would be approval. Each one of us. So each of us would have our own individual print.
Just like I'd have crescent moon shape on your.
No, see, I'd have basically like the tangerine wedge of the ass cheek.
Okay,
and then you'd come with like the watermelon squish.
Actually, on the side of it.
It's not about the size of the curve. It's the size of the spread, Zach, because we're squishing.
Ah, okay.
So relative.
Relative.
I'm going to have my little mandarin wedge, and you're going to have your little watermelon slice.
Okay.
So then we can put them side by side. That'd be cute. That'd be cute.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess next week we'll do Kids in the Hall.
Yeah, we'll definitely see about that. I'd have to watch so much Kids in the Hall.
You don't have to watch all of it because I think.
I mean, I watched it growing up, so.
Yeah, I did as well. Like, I'm going to refamiliarize myself with some episodes here and there.
And I'm probably going to take from like several seasons and just kind of.
And just digest it. Yeah, because like there isn't a whole lot of tone change because a lot of their skits are, you know, follow the same kind of theme.
There's plenty to talk about. I have to. It's one of those things when I watch again, I'm going to watch it with the eye of trying to figure out what is the draw of this show for me. Because I know there's a draw.
Absurdism.
And it's absurdism. there's also, I don't know, there's something kind of, even when you don't have a really great joke premise, like on just describing it to someone, like, yeah, this doesn't seem like a great joke premise, but the level of commitment that the comedian or artist brings to it really elevates it to another level.
Right.
I think I did see one recently, just kind of going through, was the one where they had the pet businessman.
Oh yeah.
And that is great. Because what they did sometimes too is they'd take a concept, and this is kind of, you couldn't really do this very often in something like SNL because you have like a minute kind of format, but they'd take a concept and just stretch it on way too long.
Yeah.
So then you'd come back to where he's trying to say goodbye to the businessman and like letting him free amongst the other businessmen. And it's just like, this is amazing. Why would you ever do this?
Well, we can deep dive into that next week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll see you guys here. Backrowsupershow@gmail.com.
What we should do, since I'm in the mood, we should watch some Space Ghost too.
Oh yeah, let's do that.
Absurdist mashup.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, that'd be great. That episode would be like 4 hours long.
Oh yeah. There is that too.
No, we're good. We'll have enough. We'll keep it interesting. I'll keep an eye on the timer. We'll be good.
Okay.
We did good today. Look.
I know.
1 minute.
Just over an hour. So, yeah, we'll see you guys next week. Bye.
Thanks for hanging on the back row, guys. Bye.
You're going to reap just what you sow.